I ultimately wanted to do it because that's the way I feel deep down in my heart, the direction I want to go with it. With that mindset, some of these challenging experiments or learning curves, I always had the hope for a better day, you know, to try it again and not lose the sight of it, you know, that tomorrow, next year, we can try something different, learn from it and adapt and move on, you know.
Welcome to the 393rd installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. On a recent wintry morning, I found myself negotiating curvy, icy roads in southeastern Minnesota's rugged Zumbro River Valley. After a tense drive, I finally arrived at Rolling J Farm, the ridgetop home of Alan Jostock and his family. I was there to talk to Alan about how he's using crop rotations, livestock, and no-till production to farm land that's extremely prone to erosion and runoff. It was evident that this landscape requires such a conservation-based, regenerative approach to farming. And Alan made it clear early on in our conversation that at the core of this approach to farming is a reliance on a diversity of enterprises. Such diversity makes the operation resilient environmentally as well as economically. He's a third-generation farmer, and he and his wife Betsy, along with his parents, Ed and Lynn Jostock, operate roughly 220 acres of crops and pasture land. They raise corn, soybeans, hay, alfalfa, oats, and barley. The farm utilizes cover crops, and in 2025, 100% of its acres were managed utilizing no-till. In addition, the Jostocks have a cow-calf beef herd and laying hens. They also raise pork for Nyman Ranch, which specializes in sustainably and humanely raised meats. Alan sees this kind of diversity as key to building soil health, something he's very passionate about. He serves on LSB's Soil Health Steering Committee, which guides the organization's work in helping farmers adopt practices like rotational grazing, cover cropping, diverse crop rotations, and no-till. Besides being characterized by steep ground that's highly erosive, this part of Minnesota is underlaid with karst geology, which is extremely prone to groundwater pollution. The Zumbro eventually flows into the Mississippi River, which is just a few miles from the Jostock farm. So, any farming practice that can help keep soil in place while preventing chemical runoff is a major public benefit. The Jostock's efforts to farm sustainably have not gone unnoticed. In 2025, they were recognized as Wabasha County's outstanding conservationists. Alan is especially mindful of the public benefits of regenerative farming, given that he's a member of the City Council in Hammond, Minnesota. But he also sees having a diversity of soil-building enterprises present on his farm as a kind of an insurance policy that's good for his family's bottom line. Small grains like oats or barley can help build soil biology while reducing a reliance on chemical inputs. But at this time, it's difficult to find consistently profitable markets for small grains in Alan's area. So, feeding such crops to livestock helps walk them off the farm as a value-added product, providing an economic justification for raising soil-friendly grains. And Alan thinks a lot about the financial sustainability of Rolling J Farm. He has a farm business management degree and is an advisor to Riverland Community College's Farm Business Management Program. In that latter position, he has seen how farmers who utilize a diversity of crop and livestock enterprises often are better able to weather often tumultuous market situations. Alan and I took shelter from the Arctic wind by sitting in the cab of a pickup truck while we talked about the economic and ecological benefits of having a diversity-based insurance policy. He also shared how a satellite image of farmland opened his eyes to the benefits of getting more cover on the ground, and how he doesn't see missteps on his own operation as failures, so much as quote-unquote learning experiences. So, Al, how important is diversity to you, both with the cropping and the livestock? It sounds like, I know you're very interested in soil health as well, and I guess I was curious why soil health is kind of such an important part of your farm and how diversity plays into that.
We've always been diverse. We have corn, soybeans, hay, alfalfa, oats, and barley. But diversity, I got started in that with the soil health. It come down to the erosion here. It's very hilly. And when we were conventional tillage, we'd have, you know, the rains are coming harder and faster. And we were seeing washouts and quite a bit of erosion. So that was kind of the first thing. Secondly, was time and just the input costs of diesel fuel. And I thought about it for a while. And when we're cropping 200 plus acres and we were conventional tillage, we were passing over those acres 2, 3, 4 times. Mm-hmm. As I was sitting in the tractor or combine, I was thinking, feels like we're farming 1,000 acres only to harvest, you know, 200 or 250. So that was kind of a turning point for me. The soil health benefits just kind of followed suit as I learned more about it and started doing it. It made sense to me on what was going on, not only above ground, but below ground. And so that was kind of the main thing, driver of it.
Have you seen, since you've maybe adapted some of these soil health practices like the no-till and cover crops and diverse rotations, have you seen some benefits as far as soil health or conservation benefits, environmental benefits, that type of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we started with the no-till, first it was minimum tillage, it was kind of a learning curve, and then ultimately to 100% no-till. The erosion has been greatly reduced. I actually see more erosion maybe on the hilly field roads than I do in the field now, just because tractors are running up and down the field roads. Yeah, erosion, and I've also now with the no-till, I'm starting to see the soil change, and with the cover crops and no-till, and that's exciting to see as well. I know we depleted our soils down just with the tillage and using corn stalks and corn silage and stuff, and so now with the cover crops and starting to bring the organic matter back up again.
So I know part of your background is you have a farm business management degree from Riverland Tech, and I think you're like an advisor to their farm business management program. So I think that's really critical that you bring that background into it. You grew up on the farm, and sometimes it's easy to go into farming and just go, say, I'm going to do certain things because it's the way it's been done or whatever. But you're looking at it through the lens of, okay, it's got to make financial sense. And that farm business management program is at community colleges throughout the state. It's a really respected program, and I'm really impressed how they're able to help folks kind of do some decision-making so that it makes, you know, we got to remember farming as a business. It doesn't do any good if it's not going to pencil out. But could you talk a little bit about how that's influenced your farming and kind of also influenced how you make your decisions when it comes to adopting certain enterprises? You know, you may see something, you go to a meeting and hear about a new crop or a new way of doing things, and it's exciting and it's fun to do, but it's got to pencil out, I assume. So is that something that's really important for you, is to kind of crunch the numbers and kind of look at it through that lens of financial management?
So we work with my farm business management instructor. We still currently work with her, even though I earned my degree through the college. But it was very beneficial to help us look at the numbers throughout the different enterprises, whether it was the cattle or the hogs or the crops. Something that we hadn't done prior to that. You know, we did, but when you start putting it on paper and squeezing the numbers, you can you can put values on whether it's your bedding, your grain, your hay, or the animals themselves. And she really was helpful looking at, well, what can we do to help get the return on some of these enterprises if one needs a little work versus the other. Breaking them out versus a whole farm picture was really helpful.
So kind of breaking it down and looking at each enterprise, but then looking at how that can contribute to the overall farm's financial picture.
Absolutely.
A little bit.
Absolutely. Yep. When you've seen it on paper, you could, forward thinking, you could brainstorm on how you can just change the way it looks on paper at the end of the day, and hopefully it works out that way. You're not guaranteed, but it does help you to see it that way.
So markets must be very important. You must have to look at markets.
Yeah, yep, markets are important. I tend to not lose too much sleep over, because we're diversified, if crop prices are down like they are now, beef prices are up. And so with the diversity, yes, it does hurt that crop prices are down, but I feel like right now the beef market's up, and that's helping carry the boat, or, you know, float the boat for the farm and as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I do look at them, but I tend not to, you know, overwhelm myself per se. I think there's ebbs and flows between diversity, and so that's helpful.
Can you think of a specific example where you were looking at maybe adding an enterprise or a crop or a livestock species or whatever, and you kind of went through that decision-making, that financial decision-making to figure out if it was going to work, not only financially for the farm, but kind of from a workload standpoint? You know, there's only so many hours in the day, and I know you do some trucking on the side, and you're on the Hammond City Council, I think. You're a pretty busy guy. So can you think of an example where you kind of had to go through and maybe an example of something where you were like, okay, you know, that's not going to work. We're not going to do that, even though it might be something that would be fun to try.
On the livestock side of things, when we started, we've always direct marketed our beef to family and friends. But when 5 years ago, my wife and I were talking, and we really started to push the direct marketing. And at that time, beef prices were lower. And so we saw a better opportunity for revenue selling that beef direct when we could. Now, of course, beef is up right now. So we kind of leveled out between our direct marketing price and the cash price at the sales barn. But I'm okay with that. If we don't sell it direct, it's we can just load them up, take them to the sales barn right now. But people only have so much money right now to buy direct. And so we wanted to keep our prices at least competitive with the sales barn today. But there's going to come a day when the sales barn price is going to come down. And we'll still have that clientele of the direct marketing. And we can ramp that back up and start pushing direct again, and just keep that revenue coming in for when the sales barn prices do come down. I've tried many things over the years on the cropping side. Planting green is still something I want to continue with. I've tried a couple different things. I've had some, I don't like to use the word failure, but I've had some challenges on a few instances with that.
Learning experiences, I think.
Absolutely.
And the planting green, to explain to folks who might not be familiar with, that's when you have a cover crop, and in the spring when you go to plant, you literally plant right into the living cover crop, and then you kill it off later. But it can be pretty effective, but it can be pretty daunting to plant into something that's already covered with growing green vegetation.
Absolutely. And so I've dabbled a little bit in that, and that's a goal to keep working towards that. I like that, but I don't put all of my eggs in one basket. And so if I have a challenge with it, it was on a small, till I get it, you know, worked out, it was a small portion, reduces the risk, I should say. But I haven't gone away from it, but it's a goal to try to do more of that. Learning process is correct.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
So, yeah, I won't say failures, but any other examples of learning, kind of some hard lessons you've learned or some learning processes that you've had along the way?
The interseeding of cover crops, I've done that a little too, and I've seen other people have success, and I'm learning at that. I did interseed some soybeans mid-season, and I had too much residual herbicide out there, and some of the cover grew, but it wasn't beneficial. The residual herbicide really stunted it, held it back. And so that was just a learning experience. And so, yeah, not a failure, but I learned from it. You know, I essentially went out and tried it one day. I thought, I'm going to try this, and didn't work out quite like I planned, but I gained some knowledge from it, at least, you know.
Speaking of insurance and kind of having a backup plan and a plan B, it sounds like livestock play a major role in that, not only because it's always been part of the farm, and it sounds like you enjoy working with livestock, and you've got a pretty good market. You've got a premium market through Nyman Ranch, and then you've been doing some of the direct marketing that. But it sounds like it's also, with when you're raising a diversity of crops, that it can be a real insurance policy. If you didn't have that livestock to maybe, instead of selling the crop off the farm, if you can feed it through the livestock, that gives you a kind of a little bit of a backup plan.
Yeah, absolutely. So whether you're growing oats or barley or hay, the livestock give you a great insurance policy. If you mow your hay down and you have an unexpected rainstorm, for example, that hay might not be a good enough quality to feed to the livestock, but I set those bales off to the side. And now with our pigs being on a bed pack bedding system, those bales now become bedding for the hogs, and they do well on it and really enjoy tearing those round bales apart. As far as the cover crops or oats, the barley helps me. If we don't have enough corn to feed through our animals through the summer, I raise barley, which comes in July or early August. Mm-hmm. And barley's close to corn in feed value. So there again, that gives me an option to plant a small grain and a different crop instead of just corn and soybeans. But ultimately, there's not a strong market for barley around here, if any, in this area, but I can still grow it and feed it through my animals and get a more diverse crop rotation on my land. Mm-hmm. So livestock's very important to me, that helps us create that backup and insurance policy.
The two small grains you're raising are barley and oats, is that correct?
Yep, correct.
So small grains were a very big part of the rotation here in the upper Midwest, in particular, of farms, but they, over the decades, have kind of disappeared. What was that like to kind of bring those, and when did you bring those small grains back into your rotation? And I guess, what were some of the challenges, both like maybe not having experience with that? I don't know how much experience you'd had with small grains before, but also things like equipment. It's a different, maybe some different equipment that you need and different management practices, that type of thing.
We've always grown oats here, but the barley come into play 10, 15 years ago when we were short of corn and we were looking at different options to help us instead of purchasing the corn. Mm-hmm. There was a few years that corn was $6 and $7 a bushel, and we were growing the barley, and that really helped us stretch our corn supply so that we weren't relying on purchasing corn back. Of course, that's close to oats, which we always had, so the equipment wasn't so much of an issue that way. But now I'm looking to reduce my corn acres now and focusing a little bit more on the oats and barley just for input cost-wise. And typically we've underseeded those small grains for our hay, for our animals. But now I don't need as many hay acres. I have enough, you know, so with the increased acres on oats and barley, I'm looking, and I've done it double cropping it, so the oats or barley come off, and then I can come in and use a no-till drill and no-till in a double crop as peas, triticale, or, you know, sedan grass or something like that, which I can harvest in the fall, either grazing or baling it or chopping it for forages as well. So essentially getting two crops in 1 year, you know, off those acres.
So you feed a lot, use your oats and your barley as part of your feeding program for your livestock. Have you had any luck with any markets where you're just selling the grain of the barley and the oats right off the farm? Is there anything like that around?
They're small. I know Green Acres Milling is opening up another opportunity for farmers that way. All of ours gets fed on the farm. Some local elevators look for oats for their, or I should say mills, feed mills, looking to purchase some oats, but it's a smaller quantity, and some of that has come down to the reduced numbers in livestock in the area. Years ago, there was a lot more smaller farms, and so the amount of the demand for the oats being, you know, hauled out as feed to the farms has been reduced, so that's been a little bit of, you know, they look for some, but probably not enough if everybody grew it, I guess, at this point.
Well, it strikes me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it strikes me, especially with the oats, that you can get familiar with growing it. And it sounds like you've always kind of, it's been part of the farm, but you can really get serious about growing it, even if there isn't a great off-the-farm direct market for it right now, because you have that livestock that you can. And then if there is a lucrative market that develops, you can then turn to that, because you're like, well, I have the experience. I know how to grow it. I know how to grow it in these conditions. I know what varieties to use, that kind of thing. So it seems like it's a kind of a nice, a gateway, a way to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. With the livestock, we can feed it on farm, but you're 100% right that when these opportunities open up, it's easy to shift gears and market some of it off the farm. I also have been thinking about wheat. This is not generally a wheat producing area. I know one guy that's producing some wheat, but Horizon Milling is a flour mill in Lake City, and if you can grow a quality wheat, they're willing to take it. It doesn't get talked a lot of, you know, about that. It's just the area around here, you know, wheat's kind of hasn't been grown much around here, but I have been thinking about that, and I haven't made the jump to produce a few acres, but Horizon Milling's a big company, and they have several mills throughout southern Minnesota, and so maybe that's another opportunity for people to think on trying some, you know.
Working with diverse set of crops and in integrating small grains into that type of thing, has that helped you, as far as going back a little bit to the financials, has that helped you kind of reduce your input costs a little bit, you know, your money you're spending on herbicides and fertilizers, that type of thing?
Yeah, I think it has. When you grow oats or hay or barley, you can help reduce the weed pressure versus, you know, corn and soybeans. Weeds can become a little bit more resistant. You know, water hemp in particular is one that's a challenge for everybody. But when you shorten the growing season, either by growing oats or hay, if you have some water hemp pressure out there, you're able to clip that off before it's actually able to become mature, and then which is going to reduce your seed and the spread of it. So keeping that diverse, you can help reduce some of the inputs that way, just on weed pressure alone, you know.
You know, one thing, just going on oats, I've just always been curious about this, and I always ask farmers this who've been growing oats and have a lot of experience with it. Supposedly one of the reasons it kind of disappeared from this region, one of it was less livestock, but also there was the argument that in some ways the climate changed and weather patterns changed, and it was just harder to raise oats. But what are you finding? Are you able to kind of, it's been able to work for you as far as, yeah, you know, just, they talk about getting more humid and more kind of just it lodging more and that type of thing. But has the varieties gotten better that you can raise, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of varieties out there that you can choose to fit your operation. I tend to look for a taller variety. Yes, there's the risk of it blowing down or lodging, but there's fungicide out there. We apply fungicide to our oats, and so that can help alleviate some of the humidity issues and then help it stay standing longer. I feel like it's a pretty versatile crop as far as getting it to grow and yield for you. But, yeah, I think it's more so just the amount of livestock and the reduced markets that probably push it away more than anything versus corn or soybeans, you know.
So if we can get, if we can get more people with livestock, that helps. But then also, like you said, with Green Acres Milling and some other options out there, and there's definitely demand. I mean, we're importing vast majority of our oats from Canada. So there is a real opportunity there, I think, to fill that niche with locally raised oats. I know you're on the Hammond City Council, and this is an area that is, we're in the middle of karst geology, which is beautiful. It's an awesome, just a really gorgeous part of the state. The downside is water quality is a big issue. Nitrates in drinking water is a big issue. You must have to deal with that a little bit, being part of the local city government, that type of thing. It sounds like you're able, as a farmer, you're able to bring a voice to that to say, you know, there's some positive things that farmers can do about water quality, And, you know, some of the things that you're doing, and you've been to field days and talked to other farmers that are doing these things. Is that something that you think about a lot as you're kind of just in the community in general, but also, you know, part of this, the local city government, that type of thing?
I do think about that. We don't particularly have an issue with nitrates with our city well. Neighboring cities do, and I think it really poses a challenge when you're providing drinking water and a service to the community, that when your wells are contaminated with nitrates, it, the cost to alleviate some of those issues, I think, can get really costly and time consuming, you know, where as a farmer, we got to look at trying to help reduce those nitrates entering the drinking water. Once they're in there, it's hard. I don't know if they ever leave. Just trying to look at the bigger picture, you know, long term, to save our drinking water. It's a big deal right now.
Is there anything you're excited about trying? It sounds like you're not afraid to experiment, and as you said, have these learning opportunities. Is there anything you are kind of? I know you interact a lot with, like, you're through our Soil Health Hub and some other. You're on our Soil Health Steering Committee, so you work with a lot of other farmers and, you know, check out what they're doing and go to field days, that kind of thing. Is there anything you'd like to hear in the near or far future you're excited about maybe trying out or experimenting with a little bit, or kind of doing more of something that you're already doing?
Last year was my first year being 100% no-till. We've done no-till for a number of years, but last year was our first year on every acre. So I want to continue that, fine-tuning it and making it really work. But interseeding, I've watched my neighbor interseed now for a couple of years, and I'm interested in that, and I want to try that on a few acres and just start to build a kind of some knowledge around it and see if I can make that a go. Like I say, do a few acres, and if it didn't work out the way I planned, well, you didn't put all your eggs in one basket. It wasn't a total, lowers your risk, but definitely want to try some of that.
Can you explain for somebody who might not be familiar, what's interseeding?
So interseeding it with a living cover, whether it be clover, you know, some brassicas, your turnips, or that, just trying to keep more living roots in the soil, help the biology under the ground, and then just trying to tie up some of the nutrients and hold them there, and not letting them just wash away with these heavy rainstorms. And then ultimately he as well grazed those in the fall. So he harvested his corn, and you could see all that living green coming up through the corn stalks. And he put some temporary fencing out there and put his beef cows on it. And after a couple of weeks, you couldn't see any more green. They had gotten a couple of weeks of, not to say free feed, but feed that you maybe wouldn't have to start feeding round bales as soon or something like that, you know. So that was interesting to see how that works out, and I'd like to try some of that.
Yeah, so the idea is you're growing corn, and sometime during the growing season, I know it varies, and they'll go in and try to interseed these cover crops, and then once the corn is taken off, the sunlight can finally hit that, and it really jump starts it, and you can get a real nice fall growth out of that.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's kind of where I was looking at, like when I tried it with the soybeans, the thought was is to go in there in August, that when the beans are just before they start turning, maybe seeding some cover crop in there, and as the beans die down and start to shed their leaves, the cover crop's little enough that it doesn't hinder harvest, but then we can get some nice growing days in the fall, get some of those cool season crops and really let them take off and either provide forage or just cover. I mean, one of the first meetings that I went to, or I should say one of the earlier meetings I went to years ago, they showed a map of the state and the satellite imagery of how green the state could be between May and September. And that's, you know, only just a little over a third of the year. And the rest of it was completely brown. And that was a real eye-opener of 8 months out of the year. It kind of looked like a wasteland. And I know, of course, it's winter through some of those months, but just trying to get more of that living cover from March to May and, you know, September to November really, I think, would would help overall water quality, soil health, erosion. But it was an eye opener.
Yeah, that is. I've seen that that same map, and it's, to me, the thing that struck me is like, wow, look at all that solar energy that's being wasted. It's just going. It's not being used by anything.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And you see how green it is during those summer months, the growing season, and how brown it is the other months. You think, boy, it's not as appealing when you see all the brown. And so, trying to flip that where you see green more throughout the year than you do brown. You know.
I know this is an unfair question because none of us have it all figured out and are experts. But you are familiar with experimenting, and you're not afraid to try some things, and some things seem to be working out for you. Do you have any advice for somebody who's just trying to dip their toes into the water of diversity, or trying to build soil health, whatever you want to call it, kind of adopting some of these regenerative practices, but want to do it in a low risk way? Do you have any advice for folks?
I would say just start out small. Try it on a few acres. Don't throw it all in. And if you have a challenging time with it, it was more learning than it was detrimental to your finances. Mm-hmm. I ultimately wanted to do it because that's the way I feel deep down in my heart, the direction I want to go with it. And so with that mindset, some of these challenging experiments or learning curves, I always had the hope for a better day, you know, to try it again and not lose the sight of it, you know, that tomorrow, next year, we can try something different, learn from it, and adapt and move on, you know. So I think starting small is a great way to do it, because if those challenges are there, you only have a small risk.
With this farm business management program, do you ever hear from the instructors of how what their view of having more diverse enterprises on a farm, kind of if that's a good insurance policy, or if it's a good financial strategy for folks, like, because they see so many numbers from throughout the state and they're able to compare them a little bit, like, as opposed to somebody who's just strictly corn and beans or strictly one enterprise kind of thing?
Every year they compile all the data and share it with the farmers anonymously, but at the annual meeting they talk about if beef was, for a number of years, they would say, well, it didn't look so good for the beef farmers, you know, and corn was high. So then they, you know, everybody was smiling that had corn and beans on the farm. But being diverse, like I said, it spreads your risk out, and one enterprise will help carry the other one through the good and the bad. Showing us that and putting the numbers on paper for you, it really is a whole farm. Diversity is key. If you're solely one or two enterprises or crops and they're both down, that hurts.
But it sounds like you're kind of having fun, that you like experimenting a little bit and playing around with different enterprises. It sounds like it's a little bit fun for you.
Oh, absolutely. I enjoy it. Trying things that I hadn't tried before, it's just a challenge. And first and foremost, but it's fun. I get to see how things work or don't work, and then learning. And also, throughout the rest of the year, you have time to think about that, reflect on it, and say, well, what could I do differently? Little things that maybe can make a big difference. But I truly enjoy trying things that wasn't the way we always did it. If they work out, it really makes you feel good and kind of shows you that you're going the right direction, doing the right thing, you know.
I mean, how important is kind of farmer-to-farmer education? I know you're part of our Soil Health Steering Committee and that, but getting that information directly from other farmers as opposed to maybe an expert who isn't farming or is not even from the area, or a YouTube video from somewhere, but that local farmer-to-farmer education and networking, how important is that to you?
It's really important. When I started going to the meetings and doing this, I would hear how it's working for other farmers, and I always took something away from the meetings. In my head, I was thinking, well, that's easy for you to say, you know, at the time. But I just didn't debunk it right away. I took little pieces away and learned how I could integrate that into my farm, what works here. Because 50 miles one way or the other can work, something can work really well for a farmer, and maybe not so much on your farm, but just pulling little pieces away, taking it with a grain of salt, bringing it home and just reflecting on that was is really beneficial to try to integrate some of those pieces into the operation. And then ultimately you got to find out what works for you and on your farm. And farmer to farmer, when you drive by and see your neighbor doing it, as my neighbor with the interseeding, I've kind of watched him work out some of the kinks and have talked with him and bounced ideas off each other. And then seeing it work has helped me want to try that, because we're right across the fence line, and vice versa. He's watched what I've done, and it's made him think differently and bounce ideas off me and try to integrate some of the things I do into his operation. So yeah, if we can get more people trying it in the area, I think it's going to catch on, you know, and farmers will try different things, you know. With all the things I'm involved in, there's a pile of work and management that goes into it, and trying not to spread myself too thin, but getting involved with different organizations is really helpful, you know, with my local government, with city council, with LSP, farm business management, and even just volunteering. I enjoy that, and it gives me a little bit of a voice, and I also can hear from, you know, on city council, the constituents in my town, you know, they let me know, and I try to help them, you know, try to carry their voice through to the meetings. And so being involved, yeah, it takes up some time, but I think it's really beneficial to get out there and kind of be in the forefront of things and hear what's coming in the pipeline, and helps you be a little bit ahead of the curve.
Well, I appreciate you do that. I know it's not easy to, it'd be easy just to stay here and farm and do the fun thing, but being part of the community is so key. And I think it's important, too, for the non-farmers in the community to see a farmer involved in the community and to learn some of the challenges that farmers face and kind of how important that is to the economy, but also just kind of to the societal fabric of the area. I mean, that's really key to have somebody like you involved in some of these, like the local government and the community, that type of thing.
Consumers, they want to be educated. They ask questions, and, you know, I want to be there to help answer some of those and kind of get them to be more informed about what goes on. And I think they ultimately feel more connected knowing what's happening on the farm, and I think they really appreciate that. I mean, there's been some silly questions. I wouldn't say dumb, but there's been some questions. But after you explain it to them and talk with them for a few minutes about it, I think they really walk away feeling better, feeling more informed. It helps them think about it differently, and maybe if they had a perspective one way or the other, helps them think differently about it, you know, which I think in turn helps us, you know, whether it be, you know, animal welfare or the crops. We're not out here to destroy it, and so educating some of those people is ultimately beneficial for us as well.
For more on building soil health in a way that diversifies and fortifies a farm's financial bottom line, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 393 at landstewardshipproject.org. There, you'll find information on Land Stewardship Project meetings and workshops related to diversifying with the help of livestock and crops such as small grains. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org. Or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendahl, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.